This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. We take learning for granted, but when you stop and think, it's a pretty amazing process, transmitting all that collective and personal knowledge from one individual to another. Some things, like walking and talking, we learn on our own through observation and imitation, but much of what we know came from formal learning environments like school. So how we organize our schools and the theories at their foundation play a big part in determining outcomes. On today's program, we'll examine some of those theories and the programs we create to help people learn. We start with Jeffrey Green. He's a scholar of educational psychology and learning science at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, and he will give us a lesson on how we learn and how we don't learn. Welcome, Jeff. Good to talk with you.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
As I said, it's kind of an amazing process. What do we know about what's going on with us? What are the processes inside our head? I assume that's where it all takes place, or much of it, and how it works.
Well, we know quite a bit, and while not a lot of it is intuitive, it's not rocket science, and so it can be taught. And one of the things that we have learned is that some students, because they have parents that know how people learn or have been good learners in the past, they get that information. Other students don't, and that's a real problem. We will make sure that all students know how to learn effectively. And we know a couple basic things. One is that it's really important to get students to find meaning in what they're learning. It's a lot easier to remember something when you can connect it to what you already know, when it has some meaning or value to you. So one thing that teachers are challenged to do is find ways to connect what they're trying to teach to what their students already know or value. Once students have begun acquiring the knowledge, it's really important that they space out their practice, that they don't just cram for the test the night before, but maybe they spend a little bit of time each night, maybe six nights before, learning the material, going over it. That really helps both short-term performance and long-term retention.
All right, so go ahead, keep going.
Well, a great way to do that is doing really what is a kind of an old-school method, flashcards. Right, so kind of forcing yourself to pull something out of your memory. So having a question on one side and then having the answer on the other side of the flashcard, forcing yourself to recall the information. The more you self-test, the better you learn. So rather than rereading chapters and doing things that a lot of students do, they should really be testing themselves. Those are all really powerful ways to acquire knowledge and be able to use it later in life.
Those are really good tips. Now that we have schools and we think that one form or another, they'll be with us, you know, for the foreseeable future. I am wondering back, though, to a time before schools. And the reason I would do this is to get to the biology of learning, to get some sense of what it is in us and I think other mammals, right, who can learn that makes it happen. I mean, you talk about meaning. You can imagine primates and other earlier civilizations, other earlier groups. It's important to learn how to throw that thing because that's how we stay alive. And, you know, you sort of get it right away, right? And the question I have is kind of what's going on? And then when you get into an artificial environment where it's less obvious that this is going to lead to your survival, you know, sort of how you transfer the techniques to keep meaning alive.
Well, so there's a term called biologically primary learning and biologically secondary learning. And what you're describing as far as survival and proliferation, that's all biologically primary. And humans are, you know, they've evolved to pick up that stuff pretty naturally without a lot of effort. But much of what we want to teach in schools is what we call biologically secondary. It's not how to survive necessarily, it's how to thrive. And those things require different skills, require different kinds of practice, require different kinds of interactions to make them things that you can acquire and then use in your life. And so that's where the trick comes in. That's where we have to do some things that maybe don't feel as natural, but can really help us be successful.
Are most modern classroom environments, do you think, and teaching methods designed with that in mind? Do we understand that there are certain biological imperatives that you can't just dismiss, even in an artificial environment where these secondary goals are primary?
Absolutely. And that's something that there's been a tremendous increase in knowledge and understanding and practice is that what is the area of what are the climates, what are the environments, how do we create classrooms where students want to engage in the acquisition of biologically secondary learning? So there's all kinds of things that teachers know how to do to create a sense that, you know, learning is safe here. One of the big movements right now is called a growth mindset, trying to help students understand that making mistakes is good, that not knowing something is not something to be ashamed of, that if you get a bad grade or make a mistake, that's no reason to be upset with yourself or to think that you can't do it, but rather that you just can't do it yet. And what we found is that very seemingly minor changes in how students think about learning and how we talk to students about learning can have very powerful effects upon their willingness to engage and persist in secondary learning.
Yeah, I think in the first place, you'd have to create that environment where making the mistake is what we're doing here and then learning from it, of course. But then in many subtle ways, don't we reinforce the idea that it's the perfect product that we're looking for? I mean, when we teach the inventions and some of the great accomplishments of great people, we kind of start with what they did and don't often tell the difficult story and how hard it was for them to get there and how many mistakes they made along the way.
Right, and that is one of the things that we, in a very well-meaning way, we set up students to have difficulty because we only talk about successes. We talk about outliers. We talk about how Michael Jordan was the greatest basketball player that ever lived because he won these championships. We don't talk about how many shots he missed. We don't talk about how many times at the end of the game he didn't make the shot or didn't do the right thing. We don't talk about how long inventors had to struggle and how difficult it was for them to get to the point where they did something so memorable. The more that we do that, the more that we humanize the process of learning and the difficulties of learning, the more likely it is that students are going to want to persist and want to engage in it and not question themselves when everything doesn't go exactly to plan.
Is that going to take longer? Is it going to take a student longer to get through if we let them make mistakes? And then what are the implications for end of grade testing at certain, you know, benchmarks, mile marks along the way?
Right. So we do want students to encounter what we call desirable difficulties. We want them to understand that, you know, if you're struggling here, that doesn't mean that you can't do it, that there's probably value here because we all struggle in life when we all go into our profession. There are times where things take longer than we expected. There are some practicalities of education in terms of wanting, you know, by the end of the academic year to know what a student has acquired. But to the degree possible, during the academic year, we really want to stress to the student it's about the process. It's about getting better every day. Don't think so much about that test that's coming up. Think about, do I know more today? Can I do more today than I could yesterday?
We also, there's a couple of myths we want to talk about. One of them is perhaps an overemphasis on differentiated or different learning styles. We know that everybody has preferences and some people do better in other environments than others, but you say we may have overemphasized these.
We have. It's unfortunate. Many very, very well-meaning teachers want to differentiate, want to try to figure out kind of how do I meet each student where they are and kind of set up each individual student for success. And that's a wonderful, wonderful thing that our teachers do. But one way in which they've been taught to do that is by teaching to students learning styles. So the classic one is some kids are auditory learners, some are visual learners, some need to do it to learn it. And differentiation is great, but that's not the right way to differentiate. We have done so much empirical research looking for learning styles. They don't exist. In fact, we all learn best by learning things in multiple ways, by hearing it, by seeing it, by doing it. And when we tell students you're an auditory learner, we send a message that they can't learn in other ways, and that's a dangerous message. In fact, we all learn in multiple ways. And differentiation is wonderful, but there's other ways to differentiate that are more effective besides learning style.
Another myth you talk about is the fact that we're multitasking, that we're all multitaskers, and especially in the age of digital technology, we need to just put more of that in the classroom because that's the world they're living in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that is not the case. Again, I think it's very easy for people to think, for adults to think, the world has changed since I was young, and I need to meet students where they are. You know, when the book first was invented, people thought that they would really damage learning because you wouldn't have to memorize things anymore. You'd always have a book. And, of course, now we depend upon books. We think they're fabulous. Nowadays, with technology, we notice students engaging in what they call multitasking. And some people think, well, I guess today's students have to multitask to learn, to stay engaged. And that's not true. In fact, the human brain, the wiring of the human brain, hasn't changed much over the years. We don't evolve that quickly. And the human brain can only consciously attend to one thing at a time. And when you switch from one thing to another thing and then switch back to the first, there's a cost. You forget where you were. You kind of have to remind yourself, like, oh, yeah, I was doing this. And every time you switch from one task to another, there's a cost. It slows you down and forces you to rethink. Today's students don't have to multitask to be successful. And when we tell them that we think they do, again, we're giving them some bad advice.
And they have often disabused us of that and said, look, we don't want to do this. You've got research that shows students actually, when they know they've got to get something, like to focus on just one technology or one source.
That's right. Actually, our students are the best source of information about what they want and what they need. Another good example is, you know, there's this movement to think that, well, today's students really play a lot of video games, so all learning should be in the form of a video game. And certainly there's lots of really wonderful game-based learning applications out there. But when you talk to students, what they say is, you know, there's a time for games and there's a time for learning. And if the content I have to learn doesn't fit in a game, then I don't want a game for it. Just, you know, help me learn what I need to learn in the best way possible. You don't have to force everything into this one box.
I've only given you 30 seconds for this answer, but we always hear one size does not fit all when it comes to education. Is there a way to create a program that could be somewhat standardized and scaled up for all schools?
An instructional program?
Yeah.
So, no. And that's why we have local control of schools, right? So we do want schools to kind of adapt to their students and adapt to their interests. Again, getting back to the idea of finding meaning, we want teachers to, they're professionals, they're experts. And if we give them a toolbox and they figure out what tools work best for their students.
Jeff Green is a professor of educational psychology and learning sciences at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Jeff, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Just ahead, what is the purpose of school anyway? Been asking that question my whole life. Well, it turns out the answer has changed a lot over time, and we will hear some of those answers on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Stay tuned. This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Here's a pop quiz. Why do we go to school? The answer might seem obvious, but for centuries, parents, teachers, and the government have gone back and forth about the purpose of education. The way they answered that question has played a big part in shaping how our schools are structured and what students learn inside them. Steve Stemmler is a professor of psychology at Wesleyan University. He spent nearly two decades studying the purpose of school and how that plays out in testing. And he joins us now. Welcome, Steve.
Hi, thanks.
Patricia Graham is with us as well, an emeritus professor of the history of American education at Harvard University's Graduate School of Education. Hello, Pat.
Hello.
Steve, take us back to the earliest schools, at least in our country. What was the purpose of education in those early, say, the colonial days?
Well, sure. I think so. If you're looking, you know, at the purpose of school, it really starts in earnest around 1647, which is just, you know, shortly after the landing of the Mayflower. And at that time, you can find a law on the books in Massachusetts that requires every town with 50 or more people to have a teacher of reading and writing. Townships with 100 or more need to establish a Latin grammar school. And the main objective was to produce God-fearing Christians. And so the schools there focus on the classics, Latin and Greek, but also religious principles.
All right.
And so the spiritual purpose was the very first sort of thing that got us started.
And this was available to everybody. The idea was that all of our citizens, everybody needs this, at least this much.
That's right. Exactly. And so it was available to everybody. The Latin grammar schools were publicly funded. And then over time, you know, the next, 75 years or so, this model became a little bit stagnant. Schools were changing. Society was changing. There was a need for bookkeepers, navigators, surveyors. And people felt like these schools weren't really meeting the needs of, you know, utilitarian education. They thought, you know, what would be called today vocational or career education was really more important than what was going on here, and they needed schools to develop that. And so in the mid-1700s, they started to pop up this notion of academies. And any person who had money was going to send their kid to an academy at this time because that, you know, was training them for jobs and careers and things like this. And the grammar schools were then start to seen as being for the poor and died out. And then came the Revolutionary War in the 1770s. And the interesting thing that happens here is that in the U.S. Constitution, there's no mention of the role of education. Okay, it's explicitly left out of the federal constitution. So then it becomes the role of the states to figure this out. And one of the first, the first state constitution was drafted by John Adams, second president of the U.S., in Massachusetts. And he has a very clear and detailed version or statement in there that still exists today about what the purpose of school is. And it's really broad. It's interesting. I don't have time to read it all, but I'll just hit on a couple of key points here to give you a flavor. He says, you know, okay, it's wisdom, knowledge, and virtue being fundamental to the preservation of rights need to be spread to various parts of the country and among different orders of people. It shall be the duty of the state to cherish the interests of literature and science, agriculture, commerce, manufacturing, the natural history of the country. But this is the interesting piece, the principles of humanity and general benevolence, charity, frugality, honesty and punctuality, sincerity, good humor, and generous sentiments among the people. So he's hitting a lot of really interesting themes there that relate to things like civic, the importance of civic development, the importance of social and emotional development, the importance of career vocational development, and the importance of cognitive development, sort of subject area mastery.
Patricia Graham, what's interesting to me in all of this is that it is a matter of public concern. I can imagine that there was a time, even in earlier civilizations, where there wasn't this idea that the public, that all of us needed to have a completely educated society. What's driving this, the idea that this should be a matter of public policy and public concern?
Well, John Adams, a frequent correspondent, Thomas Jefferson, writing about the same time, has a more succinct view of education for why the country needs it. When he said, if you expect a nation to be ignorant and free and in a state of civilization, you expect what never was and never will be. So when you take that statement, you then realize that we need to do something to provide, to maintain that state of civilization without ignorance. And the question is how to do that. And as Steve has observed, one of the ways to do that is to create schools. But what we have wanted from our schools has changed over time, as we as a nation have thought that the schools need to deliver different kinds of products, different kinds of consequences.
Well, give us a survey, can you? A kind of a rough ride through time on how those shifts have taken place and what's been going on politically.
Well, let's begin with the 20th century, because that is a sense of modern America. And at the beginning of the 20th century, you know, from 1900 until 1920s, the great concern was assimilating the immigrants and making them Americans. And fortunately, the school curriculum, because by 1900, public schools were pretty widespread in the United States, of varying quality, but quite widespread at the elementary level and beginning to be developed at the high school level. And the curriculum for immigrants and the curriculum for native-born Americans, fortunately, was the same. But, of course, it was quite rigid, and it was taught, most of this was taught at the elementary school level by people who were not highly trained. And pretty soon, many families, particularly well-educated families and families of money, thought that this was way too rigid for their promising little children. And pretty soon after World War I, we got a new movement, which I would call not assimilation, but rather adjustment. These families, soon to be called progressive educators, wanted individualized instruction and opportunities for their children to be able to have good social adjustment. The assumption was that these children of the well-educated would be perfectly literate, and the schools could function to help them become more creative. Well, this went on from roughly 1920, I would argue, until 1954. And by the end of it, in the 1940s, the late mid-40s, we got something called life adjustment education, brought to us by Charles Prosser and the U.S. Office of Education, which created a commission called Life Adjustment Education as something that was desirable for everybody, which embraced what they called the seven cardinal principles of education, only one of which had anything to do with what Jeffrey Green was talking about earlier, namely learning. All other six had to do with how you should live your life. And only one of those seven principles had to do with what we normally think schools are all about. Well, not surprisingly, from 1954, with the U.S. Supreme Court's decision in Brown v. Board of Education to desegregate the schools, we get a new period, and I would call that access. First of all, the theory was that it would be access for black children to enter schools which they had previously been prohibited from, namely schools with white children in the South. But more importantly, it reflected the broader dissatisfaction that the combination of the rigidity of assimilation and the amorphousness of adjustment had brought, and there was grave dissatisfaction with the schools. We recognize that in developing programs for the gifted and talented. The federal government recognized that in passing federal aid to education for schools with concentrations of poor children. Pretty soon, we got special opportunities for the handicapped who had been ignored. Then for bilingual education. Well, by 1983, we got, after nearly 30 years of this, we got another period of grave dissatisfaction with the public schools, and we got a report, A Nation at Risk, which said that our whole country is at risk because our schools are no good, and what we need is more academic achievement for everybody. This is a whole new idea, academic achievement for everybody. And the question was, how do you measure it? Well, initially we thought it was through test scores. To some extent, we still do. And I would argue we are still in the business of trying to understand what academic achievement for everybody entails.
Let's ask Steve Stemler a question now about that report you just made reference to, A Nation at Risk. Tell us a little bit more about that report and its fallout, Steve.
Sure. So the federal government didn't even have a United States Department of Education until 1979, and that's surprising to a lot of people. And so that's when the federal role started to become the cabinet-level position anyway. And 4 years later, the government sponsors of this report that produces A Nation at Risk. And exactly like Patricia says, People, it's very critical of the current state of education, says we're being eroded by a rising tide of mediocrity, it threatens our future. If a foreign power had attempted to do this to us, we would consider it an act of war. I mean, it literally says these words. And so at this point, then, we start to get interested in how are we stacking up against the rest of the world. And large-scale international comparisons come online. The IEA does the first and second international math and science study, and the third. And around this time, we get a guy named Bill Clinton, who is the governor of Arkansas, who's heading the National Governors Association panel in the 1980s. And they put out this report called Goals 2000. And one of their key goals is that the United States should be first in the world in achievement by the year 2000. And so, people respond to this idea. He gets elected as president. And one of his objectives there is to say, okay, how are we going to accomplish this? We need a national test. We got to know what everybody in the country is doing. So he puts forward this notion of a national test, which becomes controversial because, as I mentioned, the federal government, hadn't had a historic role in education. And so people get skittish with this idea and say, I don't think so. We should have the states develop the test. And so that's what happens is you get George W. Bush gets elected in 2001 and gets a bipartisan bill from Congress looking at No Child Left Behind. And one of the requirements there is that states have to develop these tests to make sure everybody's meeting the standards that are set at the federal level and progressing in that way. And so everybody starts to do that. But what ends up happening is because the states have the leverage to decide what it means to sort of meet the standard or set their cut score, you get pretty big discrepancies by state. And you can look at this large-scale test we have, the National Assessment of Educational Progress, that's been going on since the 60s. That's really a pretty good indicator of a national representation of what's happening. And the results at the state level don't match what's going on at the federal level. States are gaming the test. They're making their tests too easy to make their students pass so they don't get hit with these sanctions. So that becomes a problem. And so then you have the Obama administration come into power and revise this with the Race to the Top initiative. And what they do here is they say, okay, instead of letting each state decide, we're going to set up a couple of consortia of states. So there'd be one or two consortia. So the Smarter Balance Assessment Consortia or the PARC. And states can sign on to one or the other, and they've got to demonstrate that they're going to meet shared standards and we're partnering with industry and this sort of thing. And so that's a way to sort of help ensure that states are kind of playing a fair game.
And Patricia Graham, sort of underlying this whole timeline and all of these discussions and swings in emphasis is the question of what do we mean by we when it comes to our goals for education, right? I mean, if we go back to the colonial times, if we talk about educating everybody, the we who are making the rules weren't about to educate slaves. They weren't about to educate Native Americans because that wasn't the we. How do we decide who gets to make the policy? I mean, obviously, there are legal authorities. But who, practically speaking, Patricia Graham, weighs in on this, and how are these policies developed?
Well, I think that the most important thing to recognize is that there is tremendous tension within the society about the extent to which we really want to educate everybody well. The children of the poor in this country, some of them have done extremely well, but many of them have not been blessed with schools that maximized their opportunities for learning, and mostly we haven't cared. The aspects of progressive education at its best were always for those children of well-educated, often affluent families. And we have shortchanged the children of the poor, whether they be white or black or brown, in really lamentable fashions. And trying to fix that problem with schooling is one very difficult task.
Steve, tell us more about that idea. The fact that we don't all agree on education, and there is a sense that maybe not all children should be educated. We can see that in policies both in this state and other places that suggest that public school, for instance, for everybody, we see policies that starve that move money from that into the private sector, suggesting that people with means could have a different kind of education. Is that where we're headed, or is that just a swing that we've always grappled with?
I think it's a swing we have always grappled with, and we have not yet figured out how to resolve it. I began teaching in 1955 in a high school on the North Carolina-Virginia border called Deep Creek High School. It was an all-white school. It had 75% dropout rate between the 8th grade and the 12th grade, and this was not seen as a matter of deep concern to the school system. As a beginning teacher, I found this extraordinary that more efforts were not made for these young people, most of whose families had not been educated themselves and who were not affluent. It's only within the last 20, 30, 40 years that we have begun to take seriously the problem of educating those young people who are not in communities that take formal education seriously. And this is a big problem for us. The opportunities for minorities and for women to have alternative jobs other than teaching has taken many gifted people out of the teaching force. And we're now happily seeing gifted people go back into teaching. But too often, the people who have been our teachers have been people who may themselves be highly intelligent, but who lacked in their own experience the opportunities for a first-class education. And therein lies a great difficulty.
Steve Stemler, where do you see us today?
Yeah, I mean, I think people have a tendency to underestimate the diversity of purpose in the United States educational system. It's often talked about as if there's a single purpose, as if, you know, there's a right or wrong answer to this. And I think historically, you know, it's been answered at the local level. People get to determine what their priorities are, even at the school level. And, you know, I've done a lot of work looking at school mission statements in a variety of different contexts across a variety of states and analyzed thousands of them. And three of the main things that come up are civic development, emotional development, cognitive development. And those emphases are fairly consistent over time, but which one takes, you know, center stage shifts and evolves like we talked about at the beginning. One thing I want to point out on this regard, too, is that, you know, colleague Damian Babel and I wrote a book on school systems, different school systems looking at their mission, where we looked at schools, Waldorf schools, Montessori, various charter schools, private schools, public schools in the U.S., and there's a lot of difference in terms of what they're out there saying they exist to do. And just to give you one contrast, the Waldorf schools are a set of schools that are very progressively oriented. They're very humanistic. Their missions talk about striving to fulfill potential. There's no mention of career or vocational orientation whatsoever in there. It's all about the process of learning. And this is very famously where many of the tech giants send their own children in Silicon Valley. Is, you know, there's a big write-up in the New York Times a couple of years ago about how many of the titans that they send their kids to the Waldorf schools. By contrast, if you look at schools like many charter schools like the KIPP schools that have found success in their community that mostly serve underrepresented minorities, high minority enrollment, what is their focus? Their explicit focus is on job preparation and college readiness. Their success is defined by the outcomes, the products of education. And so you see even discrepancies still within the system, but both of those are, by their own community standards, judged as pretty successful. I mean, within their community, the people that are sending their kids are pretty satisfied with both of those kinds of models. So it's hard to impose a definition from on top, I think.
I want to thank you both. Steve Stemmler, professor of psychology at Wesleyan University. Patricia Graham is a Charles Warren professor of history of education emerita at Harvard University's Graduate School for Education. Thank you both for being on the program.
Thank you. Thank you.
Coming up, schools that are looking at new models for education. Stay tuned. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow. School is a place, but learning, that can be a mindset. And as public schools emphasize testing and cater to the average, other models are popping up to offer an alternative. Non-traditional schools range from those that provide project-based learning to outdoor experiential learning and student-led democratic education. And they all have one thing in common. They focus on the learner, not the school. Here to explain some of this is Ulka Joshi Hansen. She is an associate director for Education Reimagined. It's a nonprofit that works to accelerate the growth and impact of learner-centered education across the United States. Ulka, welcome to The State of Things.
Hello, how are you?
I'm doing well. I get a sense. Is there a way in which we're moving away from a kind of that industrial it's an industrial model, I guess, of education, right? Training citizens to learn the things they need to be good citizens and obedient with an agricultural calendar. I mean, it just seems a little bit outdated. Are we moving away from that or not? Is it just my imagination?
Sure. No, I think there are two ways in which we can think about that. We can think about the why of education, which your last segment focused a lot on in terms of what is the reason that we are educating. And then there's the how. And so if I can separate those two out for a minute, the why of education in a lot of ways, and this was touched on, really was about trying to get kids coming out, or let's say right now for the last 20, 30 years, it has been about trying to get all kids out with some predetermined set of skills, knowledge, dispositions. And so there is a way in which there's some pushback against that, I think, because for a number of different reasons. I think we are beginning to think a lot about neurodiversity and the idea that different brains work differently and are good at different things. The idea that we don't actually know what the world is going to need and that, you know, developing different types of skills and different types of capacities is important. And right now, with the development of artificial intelligence and technology, there's a real question about whether some of the cognitive skills and the content that we've been focusing on are things that artificial intelligence and technology can do better. And so is there something about this deeply human part of people that we need to develop and those deeply human capabilities? So Sorry.
Well, it sets up a real challenge for us, doesn't it? I mean, on the one hand, you can imagine that any society has a responsibility to think about this and say, here's what we want from our children. We want a system that provides a certain thing. On the other hand, given all of the diversity that you suggest, is the notion of public education a kind of a fool's errand? Should we really leave it to parents to decide, you know, how best to do and then hope that when it all comes out, we're all well served?
Well, I think we would say that, you know, the public education system is a hugely important good because that is where there are certain common definitions and sort of ideas of what it is that we want people to come out with. So, no, this is not about saying that public education is not relevant. It is about saying that public education can, A, think differently about what it is that they're trying to do, the purpose of it. And then the second piece is that how, right? So is it something, you talked about the industrial model of education and people like to talk about that. But, you know, what they're trying to describe there is that, you know, it's about the adults making the decisions about the what. And there's an assumption that learning is something that you do to kids. So if you can flip that around, we talk about learner-centered education, where the presumption is that people learn from birth. We are naturally wired to do that. And so learning is something that we do with children, but it's done by children. It's not done to them. And the idea of it is that it's driven by students, their interests, their passions, their purpose, where they want to go, their development, developmental needs, their cognitive needs, as opposed to driven by what the adults have determined they want out of it. So I think I don't think this is a question of whether public education is relevant. I think it's a question of how public education thinks of itself and what it does and how it does it to reflect the different world and the increasing diversity of the learners that we're trying to serve. One of your last guests talked a little bit about the civil rights era and Brown versus Board and IDEA, so the Americans with Disabilities Act, and the expectation that all of a sudden we were really going to serve all students and not just some students. And part of what's happened is that we've continued to narrow what it is that we do, how we do it in terms of the cognitive needs of students, in terms of, you know, who those students are, what backgrounds they come in with, what assets they come in with. And we've tried to shove everybody into the same box instead of widening our perspective of what it can look like.
And let's say that what it looks like, that one of the things, let's say that at some point we all agree that a learner-centered education would be better. In other words, working from the student out. How does that, and there could be broad diversity in how you achieve that. And building by building, you might have very different models. But we're going to focus on we're going to start with the child. How would that look? How does that play out? And is it something that you can convert to fairly easily? Could a public school now that's up and running look at us and doesn't do that now? It's really focused on most schools start with the lunch schedule. That's the first thing they make. Then the bus schedules when they pick the kids up. And then after that, there's something like maybe geography.
Right.
So you'd flip that. But can you do that? I mean, is that a practical thing? And given what we have today, how would it look?
Sure. So we see a couple of things. The first thing we see is this shift from school-centered to learner-centered. And for us, that's a mindset shift, right? It really is thinking differently about the purpose of what you are doing for learners. And that mindset shift is arguably one of the harder pieces to do because there are a lot of people who are still sitting inside of a kind of school-centered traditional system, and they're innovating and they're reforming, and they talk about blended learning or personalized learning, or we're doing competency-based education, or we're doing project-based. But it really is still driven by this idea that all kids will get to the same place and that place has been determined by the adults. So the first thing you see is that mindset shift, and that does happen, and it does not matter. This is not about traditional public schools or charter schools or independent schools or private schools. We see both teachers and leaders and schools across this country in all sorts of environments that are trying to do this. So we can come back to that because I think it's a question of how the external systems and structures either enable and support that or work against it. So that first piece we see, though, is that mindset shift. And then once you've gone into that learner-centered space, we see that schools start playing with five different elements. The first is learner agency, this idea that the learner is the one who owns the learning and does the learning and that the adults are there to support. The second element is this idea of socially embedded, that learning is a social endeavor. You know, it's not about just sitting at a screen and taking it in yourself. You're both learning with other adults, with other learners, but also that education is about you becoming a social being, right? A person. And so there's an element of that, which I think we try and capture in our social and emotional learning piece. But it's about what does it mean to become a person, and that's a socially embedded activity. And then we talk about personalized, relevant, and contextualized. So these schools take very seriously the idea that personalization isn't just about saying, look, every kid is going to get to the same goalpost, but they can do it in 2 weeks or 2 months, or they can do it sitting at a couch or sitting at a desk, or they can do it on a computer or with a book, right? That's not really personalization. Personalization is, again, you start with the learner. Who are they? What are their strengths? What are their passions? What are their interests? And you use that as the entry point to dive into things, and you make it relevant to their life. And it's contextualized in that you're not just sitting there looking at a book or looking at a piece of paper. It's in the world. It's out in the world. And that relates to the fourth element, which is open-walled. So, you know, the learning does not happen inside the walls of a building. The entire community and world becomes the playground for learning. And you're learning in all sorts of places and ways, and learner-centered schools play with the environment of making that happen. And then the last piece is that it's competency-based. So the idea is that you are learning in all sorts of ways and places, and the question is, how do you get, and I'm using air quotes here, credit for that learning? So you're learning when you do Boy Scouts. You are learning when you go to a museum. You're learning when you go home and try and like start a project and do it on your own. And how are we actually identifying the learning in the things that you do and recognizing how you're developing competencies? So those are the five elements. And I'll just say up front, right, there are people who are still trying to innovate and reform inside the school-centered system that use a lot of that same language. But because of that mindset shift, it looks totally different in learner-centered environments.
And it seems to me that what you've described, of course, intuitively, you can see how that works best. I'm working with the interest of the student. I can get them to collaborate. I can have each of their unique skills contribute, and then they've learned something else in the process, that me being great at this doesn't mean I'm great at that, but that individual who may not be a great reader really contributed, or all that stuff gets mm-hmm. learned. There are two things kind of back office that are inherent in this. And that is, first of all, teachers who understand all of this and how to mm-hmm. do it, because it's quite different to, I mean, it would be quite a failure if you said, what are you kids interested in today? Okay, let's do that mm-hmm. without the competency part that you put at the end. Somehow we do want you to know something when this is all over.
Yep.
And then so one, how do we train teachers to be able to first intuit and draw from students their interest and then guide them to competence at the end? And number two, test it. Figure out a way to know at some level that you've gotten it at some point, whatever point we decide is important to measure.
Right. So I will say, and your last guest pointed this out, right, it is not as though this is not already happening. It is happening in public schools, but it is primarily happening in independent and private schools all over this country. Different models like Waldorf, like Montessori, independent kind of one-off private schools. So the idea that, you know, we know how to do this. The question is, how can we bring this to the public system, and how do we spread it? It is a different type of teacher preparation. I think there are a lot of teachers who do this intuitively or want to do it intuitively and can't. But from a preparation standpoint, right, learning how to do this is often happening. It's almost a learner-centered notion of preparing teachers. So you're not going to sit them in a classroom and lecture at them about this. You're going to put them in an environment where this is being done, and they are going to watch and grow with mentor teachers and other teachers who are doing this and kind of learn how to do this as they are watching it being done, and then sort of be released into that process themselves. And this is a lot about, this is what we see other countries doing. You know, people talk about Finland and Singapore and how they train teachers, and there are elements of this that are happening in those systems. And the other piece you asked about was about the outcomes. And that is a hugely important question, because until we open the conversation up about outcomes, which I don't think we have done sufficiently, we will continue to try and work towards the articulated outcomes that we have right now, which for the most part are kind of tested on standardized tests, and they are the foundation for accountability systems for learners, for teachers, for schools, you know, all of that. And it's almost like you can't make progress, because my intuition is, and I think the people who do this work believe, that these things are sometimes fundamentally in tension with each other. But there are ways of measuring outcomes. Again, schools that have been engaging in learner-centered education, they use portfolios of work where students are demonstrating what they are learning over time. They're using exhibitions. They're using projects. They are using internships and the things that are produced in the real world for real-world outcomes to demonstrate what kids are learning. So this is happening. It's been done. And what's fascinating is that the data around it is really interesting. The New York Performance Standards Consortium is probably one of the longest-running experiments around it. So it started in 1987. And it's all practitioner-designed assessment tasks. So it's really authentic. It's tied to what the learners are doing. All student subgroups had higher rates of high school and college completion in these schools, right? More English language learners, more special ed students were graduating than their peers in the New York system as a whole. Persistence rates in college were higher for students that graduated from these schools in terms of the, you know, we talk about the achievement gap between African American and Latino students. Those were closed. The suspension rate was lower. So there is evidence that this works. And I think there are also, there's a lot of money and a lot of interest that sit inside the current system that, you know, we haven't spent as much time kind of asking the different questions.
Who is, well, maybe you can give us some examples of some non-traditional schools, just maybe a couple, just to give us a sense of what's happening out there and some diversity in ideas.
Sure. So a couple of them were mentioned. So in North Carolina, there are several expeditionary learning schools, Evergreen Community Charter School in Asheville, Two Rivers Community School in Boone, the Expedition School in Hillsborough. And these schools are based on design principles by a gentleman named Kurt Hahn. And it really is about the primacy of self-discovery, right? Having wonderful ideas, students taking ownership for their learning, developing empathy and caring, success and failure. It is project-based and integrated units. So the idea that content isn't divided up artificially, it all happens together and things are learned together. There's also a very strong adventure component. So Kurt Hahn believed really strongly that part of being a healthy human being was engagement with nature and time for solitude and reflection. And so these schools have a lot of that built in. Montessori schools are probably one of the kind of largest alternative schools in the U.S. in terms of long standing. They go all the way from kindergarten, early childhood, all the way through 12th grade. And these schools, you know, some people sometimes believe that they're really rigid, but what they actually do is they prepare an environment for learners that is developmentally appropriate and has materials in it that are carefully designed. And then inside of that, they're allowing learners to make a lot of choices. And, you know, I just want to point out here that when we talk about learner-centered and we talk about this idea of giving students and learners agency, that's going to look different for a 5-year-old than it will for a 15-year-old. And so sometimes I think people go in their minds to this idea of, you know, 6-year-olds running around loose and not having any structure. And, you know, that is not what happens in these schools. The teachers, to your point, have been taught and are very thoughtful about how to do this. I would say nationally, there are some really interesting public schools that are out there. The Met School in Providence, Rhode Island is a high school they're very small schools, and the students starting in 9th grade are out in the community doing internships, and so they will cycle through as many as kind of 12 internships over the course of their time at the Met, and they are taking all of the learning, everything that they're doing, and they're bringing it back into the school, and the school is essentially translating it into what have you learned, and translating it into the things that the current system wants and needs. Iowa Big is a school in Cedar Rapids, Iowa, also a high school, and it is entirely project-based. Students have to conceive of the project. They have to get community partners involved, and students are building hydroponic stations. They're kind of out in the community building murals. They're basically addressing real-world problems that community partners have helped them to generate, and they're learning in that way.
We are going to have to put the rest of your examples on our website, Ulka, but it's a pleasure talking with you. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Ulka Joshi Hansen is Associate Director of Education Reimagined, a nonprofit that works to accelerate the growth and impact of learner-centered education. You can find links to her work and her organization at our website, stateofthings.org. State of Things produced by Anita Rao, Charlie Sheldon Orman, Laura Pelliser, and Jennifer Brookland. Robin Copley is our technical director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.